This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. Great to have you with us for the Wednesday, August 28th edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Jennifer Kuiper, and the Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. And on today's Noon Business Hour, we'll talk about the yield curve, the latest on Brexit, Lord & Taylor finding a buyer, and United Airlines frequent flyer miles no longer expiring. Also, Personal Finance Wednesday, how to recession-proof your portfolio. Well, change, as we mentioned, is coming to United Airlines' frequent flyer program. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, government bonds top the headlines today, along with the latest on Brexit. We're joined by Carl Riccadonna, chief U.S. economist, Bloomberg New York. Thanks for joining us, Carl. And
Good afternoon.
It's great to have you with us. Just want to get down to the basics because we hear terms thrown at us all the time. For those who don't know what it is, in a nutshell, what is the yield curve?
So the yield curve is the profile of interest rates, which under normal conditions, if I'm offering to lend you money, you would demand, I would demand a higher rate of return for the longer period of a time that you would be holding that money. So short-term interest rates tend to be well below longer-run interest rates. When the economy is weak, that relationship often flips. And so when longer-term borrowing rates are lower than shorter-term borrowing rates, that generally means that lenders are expecting a weakening economic outlook.
Now, we've seen the yield curve inversion that worsened yesterday. Is it really a good forecasting tool this time around when it comes to people talking about recession or the possibility of a recession?
Well, every economic cycle, forecasters have to determine whether signals are meaningful or not. So when we look at the whole host of indicators, then we get a better indication rather than looking at just one or two narrow metrics. So generally, when the yield curve is inverted, that's a signal that the central bank has raised rates too high. And if they don't back off, then the economy will weaken as a result. What's different in the current environment is that the central bank has already started reducing interest rates and is likely to continue doing that for the foreseeable future. My team here in New York anticipates a quarter point rate reduction at the September meeting, another one in October, another one in December. And so the Fed is really trying to ease off of the brake pedal so that they can extend and prolong an already record-long economic expansion.
One of the things you mentioned was the central bank. So that brings me to Dudley, a former president, New York Fed president, Dudley. And Bill Dudley, he was talking about, he did an op-ed in Bloomberg, and he talked about the Fed and some moves and basically saying that the Fed shouldn't cushion trade impacts. But then it took an interesting turn because it went pretty political. What do you think of Dudley's comments and the direction that it took?
Absolutely. So just for those who haven't had the benefit of reading it, he basically suggested that the Fed draw a line in the sand and not continue to aid and abet the president as he exacerbates the trade tensions with China. And he kind of went into the realm of saying that the Fed should just stop, and then that will give the president a weaker economy with which to run on his reelection ticket next year. So it really looked like a politicization of the central bank, which is notoriously independent of political pressures. So this did certainly ruffle feathers among policymakers and politicians that the Fed actually would consider taking an active role in influencing the outcome of an election. After all, as they said back in 1992 for President Clinton's first term, it's the economy, stupid, and the Fed has a very heavy finger on the scale of determining economic outcomes. So they could have some influence in that capacity in 2020. That being said, the Fed has come out very clearly and said that we would not engage in such practices.
Carl Riccadonna, chief U.S. economist, Bloomberg, thanks for joining us. And coming up, United Airlines makes a major change involving frequent flyer miles. Chicago-based United Airlines is joining Delta and JetBlue by removing expiration dates on its frequent flyer miles. Let's discuss the change with Ken Goldstein, president, KJG International Consulting here in Chicago. And Ken, why this move now? It seems that JetBlue and Delta already beat them to this, but is this a little bit of a follow what the other guys are doing or something different?
I don't think so. First off, good afternoon, Jennifer, and thank you for having me on. Yeah, Delta has been the bad guy in some respect because they modified their program, and then the other airlines followed through in getting the miles not renewed, and now United has kind of changed and followed and made these miles extended, non-renewable, renewable. They're always there. It's more of a program to get you to fly more and get active, use their credit card, buy items through certain purchases. I think it's a more aggressive part action on United's part, not necessarily to follow what Delta is doing, but United's got a good program going on. Oscar Munoz, their CEO, has really turned that airline around. And if you've flown them recently, you can see it. There's a tremendous esprit de corps on the carrier.
And airlines make money off of the loyalty programs by selling frequent flyer miles to the banks when customers use their co-branded or the other rewards cards. It has to be a substantial amount of money we're talking about here in order to do this. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it.
Billions of dollars. And in United's case, they are tied in with J.P. Morgan Chase. So the Mileage Plus card is very good for them. They've got miles in the bank. Again, you don't want these billions hanging over their leg like to get people to use them. And remember, the key here is when United's done it. United has done it. Now we're going in. They announced it, although it's effective immediately. They're going into the third quarter, which traditionally is not a heavy travel period. And also the first quarter is not a heavy travel period. The only heavy travel period we see now upcoming is going to be Thanksgiving and, of course, Christmas. So that's the time when they want to get people to start using them and start buying and flying. So the key here, United's good move.
And they've been pushing these credit cards in flight as well. As soon as you get ready to land.
Each of the airline has a tie-in, American with Citi, Delta with American Express and things like that. But you got to remember, there's a hometown thing here with United in the fact that if you go back to the predecessor of what J.P. Morgan was Bank One and then First Chicago, and that's where the credit card started. So, again, the operation here is hometown, big push, and go fly United.
And one of the things I would think they're trying to do is get the business travelers to also come back to the airline when they're doing their vacation traveling as well. Do you find that's working at all?
It does, but again, you know, it's more that now that they've got the operation, if you're business traveling, you've got all these miles in the bank, so to speak. The encouragement is, hey, bring along your partner, bring along your kids, let's fly. Make it more of an extended thing. So there's the tie-in, not only just for United to get additional passengers, but hopefully with their partners on their loyalty program, the various hotels and things like that. The bottom line here you got to think about is the miles expiring may sound positive, and independently, ultimately, it is. Every frequent flyer program has budgets and limited resources. They're essentially investing in those who can't be bothered to earn a single mile every 18 months, presumably on some level at the expense of those members who are active. The key here, they want to get people to remain active. And by having the miles renewable or extending them, they hopefully will get them on board.
Thanks, Ken Goldstein, President KJG International Consulting in Chicago. Up next, retailer Lord & Taylor is changing ownership.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Parent company Hudson's Bay is selling Lord & Taylor for $100 million to clothing rental service Latote. Let's break down the deal with the help of a man who ran Lord & Taylor for nearly 20 years, Jan Rogers Niffen, CEO, J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide in New York. Thanks for joining us. Lord & Taylor has struggled as more people shop online, but it does have an online presence. Was it late to the game? Where has it been lacking? Fashion trends, overbuying, a combination of things?
Hey, the world got a lot harder. We bought Lord & Taylor in 1986 and ran them until 2005 when they went to Macy's. Macy's sold them. They became part of a levered company, which is Hudson's Bay Corporation. So they had less money to invest in them. And what money they did invest, they just invested in their sister, Saks, rather than Lord & Taylor. But Lord & Taylor was already struggling at the point in time that Hudson's Bay bought them, because the world had sort of passed them by. The country club dress business they were the biggest dress seller in America at one point in time. They may still be, but the dress business isn't what it used to be.
Right.
And we also don't really see that country club dressing set when we had them, we had to close a third of the stores because they were already not producing as well as they should. And so it's not a surprise to me that it's just continued to deteriorate. The bad news is it's a sad situation because, you know, it was founded in 1826 as Lord's, and they added Taylor in 1836. So either way, it's the oldest department store in the U.S., not as old as its sister, which is a company founded in 1670 in Canada, but still, which is also the oldest corporation in North America.
A legacy.
So those things have been around forever, but they're going away no matter how much we love the name and no matter how much we went there as a kid and how many great restaurants they had in the stores at the time. You know, it's just not, they've been passed by the internet and the death of the malls and all the things that are going on.
What do you think about Letote getting involved in this? That's a clothing rental service, and in the deal going for $100 million. That doesn't seem like that's a lot, but in the business world, in the world, in the business world, not so much.
Well, you have to remember, Hudson's Bay already sold the big store, Lord & Taylor, in New York for $850 million. So most of the value went away at that point in time. So it's not too surprising that the value is substantially lower since they've already gotten $850 million out of the deal. And what they're buying really now is the intellectual property. Hudson's Bay has actually retained the right to the real estate that exists. So what they really want is to use the stores, to use the name, and to try to build their rental business around that. But, you know, rental and resale, as I say on your show all the time, is hot as hell right now. It's a very, very strong business. And it's growing at 40% a year, and it's already a $40 billion a year business. So being in that, the tote's in the right place. It's where the real growth is coming. People want to use Uber. They want to use Airbnb. They want to rent their cars. They want to buy clothes that have been used before. It's just where the mindset of the consumer is today, and it feels much more environmentally friendly than going to, H&M or Forever 21 and buying a $7 blouse and throwing it away after two wears. It's a changing mindset, and I think Letote's in the right place. And I think this will help them a lot because now they'll have a physical footprint, and they'll have a great name to use because no matter how much damage has been done to Lord & Taylor, Lord & Taylor is a name that still resonates with people. They all know it means classy, good clothes.
Thank you, Jan Rogers Niffen, CEO, J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide, New York.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Kuiper. These are the top stories on the Noon Business Hour, presented by the Village of Bedford Park. As talks of a potential recession warms up, it's a good time to reassess your investments. We'll learn more in Personal Finance Wednesday. Apple apologizes for listening to conversations on Siri. We'll discuss privacy in an increasingly connected world. The state of Illinois takes another step in its effort to sell the Thompson Center in downtown Chicago. And Tropical Storm Dorian is gaining power in the Caribbean and nearing hurricane strength. Business on Wall Street, the Dow is up 196 points. The NASDAQ is up 16. S&P 500 up 14 points. And AccuWeather says sunshine mixing with clouds, windy, a high 76. It's 72 degrees. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues at 12:31. Markets are higher today. We are joined by Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital and author of the book Calculated Risk. And he joins us here in Chicago. Michael, thanks for joining us. And what do you think about, I guess you could get whiplash watching the markets this last week. Right now we're up and up pretty good on as far as the Dow is looking right now. 195 points is what it's up. What's your take on today?
Well, good afternoon, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on. You know, the market has, as you said, has been pretty volatile lately, and it seems to just kind of move based on rumors out of China, out of the United States, based on the trade tensions. And today, what's kind of pushing things up is crude oil. So, you know, really, which crude oil has not led the market in many months. It's actually been dead money for 5 years. But today, inventory numbers were pretty bullish. So we got oil up a couple percent. It's kind of leading the Dow and the S&P up higher. But really, we're kind of treading water here as we wait to hear what's the next shoot a drop in China and the U.S. And that might be a Trump tweet or it might be news out of China, and we really don't know.
Well, how long is too long when it comes to dragging this out, the trade dispute with China?
Well, you know, there is no precedent for this level of trade tension between the world's two largest countries. So it's hard to, I wouldn't want to say how long is too long. It really is a matter of what is in the U.S.'s best economic interests. Do you take on China now, take the pain, and hope that you can negotiate a better deal? That certainly seems to be President Trump's strategy. But the problem is that China is unlike any other trade partner we've ever had, in that they are equal to us in their economic might, and they may not back down. It's easy to negotiate trade deals with countries like Canada and Mexico because they need us. China, you know, 10 years ago, this has been a different situation. Now, the question is, will China behave and back down? And my guess is no. So the question is, do we keep pushing this? Do we gain anything in the long run by keeping these trade tensions going, or do we back down? I mean, certainly, it's not Trump's MO to back down. Mm-hmm. So I would expect this to just be a prolonged battle, and I don't think either side is going to flinch for a while.
Well, since we're speaking globally, let's talk about what's going on today, Brexit. There were some interesting things taking place overseas. Thoughts on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson suspending Parliament until looks like October. And this is a crucial time for Brexit. Also interesting was that the Queen approved this, and she pretty much tries to stay out of politics.
Right. So he looks like he wants to kind of keep the period that they can negotiate it down to a minimum, so that it is more and more likely to be a hard Brexit, and that certainly has hurt the pound. The pound's down again today, and I think the last check I added was 122, which that's a very low number for the pound. It, probably the lowest it's been in decades. Does that mean that Brexit is not what should happen? Well, the it's a democracy, and the vote was to have Brexit. So I don't want to get political here. There was a democratic process. They voted to do it. It looks like that the Prime Minister is going to force it to happen. So we will see. This was a surprise today, and it does look like that Brexit is going to happen.
And Michael, that brings me to my next question. If there is a no-deal Brexit, meaning that this is really just a kind of a nasty divorce where just the Britain leaves without any kind of a transition period, is there an opportunity for the U.S. and U.K. to work together?
Well, certainly we've had great relations with Great Britain ever since about 1785. So that's kind of when things started getting better. But, I do think that we certainly will benefit from this. But I also think, and I've said this, that the pound is a buy here. I think that market reaction and sentiment is just overly bearish, and that once Brexit does happen, people will realize it's nowhere near as bad as what, and I've seen this a million times in many markets. It's an overreaction. I would be buying British pound significantly here. And I think that you'll see this in the second half of this year as we go into the end of the year. If Brexit happens, or if it doesn't, either way, the pound will rally back to probably 130, 135. So I think this is a great opportunity to kind of sell the news when it actually happens, because it's going to be an opposite reaction of what people think. It's already depressed way beyond where it should be.
And very quickly, Peloton's IPO, what's the thinking here? They're seeing growth, but they're losing money. Why?
This company, so it's $900 million revenue. They're going to go public, it looks like, at an $8 billion valuation. So you're looking at 9x sales. Now, Beyond Meat, some of these other ones, Snapchat, none of them make money, and they're trading at higher multiples than that. So this might be a buy. I personally do not buy IPOs where you've got multiples near 10x sales. I don't think that's a long-term win proposition. But compared to some of these other recent IPOs, this isn't poorly priced. It's just that the company's bleeding cash. It's losing $250 million a year. Hey, the question is, can this model end up down the road 5 years from now and make money? I'd rather let someone else figure that out, and I'd rather go with stocks that I believe in that are still high-growth stocks that are actually making money.
Michael Palumbo, founder of MJP Capital and author of the book Calculated Risk. Thanks for joining us. Up next, in Personal Finance Wednesday, taking stock of your portfolio as talk of a recession looms.
This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. Today, we're focusing on your investment strategy at a time that includes worry of a possible recession. We're joined by Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecasts newsletter. Welcome, Chuck. Investors, I see, co-founder of DataTrack Research, observed on August 8th that Google searches for Dow Jones were higher than they were in May. So it looks like the average investors are really paying attention to what's going on here.
Well, they are, and there's been a lot of discussion about a possible recession. You have the inversion of the yield curve, which is somewhat of an ominous indicator for recessions, although the timing of the recession is usually not instantly after you see that. So, but certainly there are people kind of wondering, and we've been getting some questions, too, in terms of, you know, what should we be doing, how should we be positioning a portfolio, what should we be thinking about in terms of kind of weathering a recession.
And one of the things that's interesting is you say when you start to revisit the portfolio, also understand your cash flow. And I'll tell you what, the automakers could have used that back in the last recession with, you know, because then they wouldn't have had to go through the bankruptcy they went through because the banks froze up. But you really say you need to understand your cash flow to protect yourself.
Well, sure. I mean, the biggest risk, quite frankly, in a recession is not so much at your stock portfolio will go down. I mean, if you have, you know, ample investment time horizon, you know, that shouldn't be a problem. I mean, if you go back to 2008, 2009, the market got cut in half, and the Dow was around 6,000, 6,600. It's gone up fourfold since that. So, it, you know, portfolios do come back. The biggest risk, obviously, in a recession is one where, you know, if your job is in jeopardy, and that's where the cash flow issue comes into play. Do you have enough of a cash reserve? And typically, you know, financial planners look at 3 to 6 months to kind of weather the storm, so to speak, if your job situation does change. And that's probably the biggest, you know, near-term risk that a lot of folks face in a recession is just, you know, is their job safety, and can they kind of, again, sustain themselves without having to tap into their investments and so forth, you know, during the period where they may be out of work.
How often should you review your asset allocation?
You know, you could do that. You know, some people may do it every day, and that's probably a mistake. I mean, typically every 12 to 24 months, I think, is probably prudent to do that. And certainly if you're thinking about a recession and you haven't checked your asset allocation in a while, that's certainly something that you should do. But, you know, asset allocation should be set not so much with a recession in mind over the next 6 months, but really what an investor is looking at over the next 5 to 10 years at a minimum. So I'm not sure you necessarily should be making significant adjustments to an asset allocation if, in fact, you had set that with, again, a 5 to 10 year investment time frame in mind and not necessarily thinking that you could time your way in and out of market downturns caused by a recession, because you're not likely to do that. You may get lucky, but to do that over time is really a fool's errand. It's better, again, to allocate a portfolio, check your asset allocation, see if it makes sense, not just for the next 6 months, but more for the next 5 to 10 years.
That's Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecasts newsletter in Hammond, Indiana. Thanks for joining us. And join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, Apple says it's sorry for monitoring customer conversations on Siri.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Apple is apologizing for allowing contractors to listen to some of the things people spoke to the electronic assistant Siri. We welcome Paul Hochman, president of Humongous Media and former tech editor for the Today Show. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. And why had Apple been allowing contractors to listen to what turns out to be, I guess, a small percentage of things that people spoke to Siri?
Yeah, they were letting them listen because their goal was to, ideally, at least in a vacuum, which, by the way, we are not in, but in a vacuum, they were going to try to improve Siri's performance by taking a look at what customers said when they said said anything to Siri. Did, in fact, Siri respond the way, after a human being listened to that command, did Siri respond in the way that the customer wanted? So that was the goal. The goal was, hey, can we make this more accurate?
And if that was the goal, and it was a legitimate goal, why would Apple do this when there have been so many privacy concerns involving other tech companies? And is it more of a do without permission now, apologize later thing?
You know what? I can't interpret their motives. I can say, you know, as far as apologizing later type thing. But I will say this. It's an admirable goal, but it is absolutely fraught. Every single major tech company, and frankly, all the smaller ones too, are just as you said. They're all hypersensitive to the idea of security, the idea of personal details and data getting out there. And this is clearly an example where a whole bunch of people were able to listen to less than 0.2%, said Apple, of those requests. But nonetheless, people did. And by the way, Google admitted in July that contractors they had hired leaked 1,000 voice recordings from Google Assistant, that's similar to Siri. And the same thing, and even Amazon is now letting you opt out of the Alexa program, which allows Amazon to interpret those commands. So it's a terribly difficult conversation right now, and it's literal conversation.
And Paul, is there any way for someone to find out if they were one of those who were listened to?
No. Short answer is that's another thing that's really making people upset. And that's that you cannot figure out whether or not the company has done this with your vocal commands by asking, by querying. You can literally just turn on or off that security setting. So we're all in the dark.
And Apple says it will still be working on Siri and looking for, is it more of a voluntary thing now? Is that what it is?
That's right. You get to opt in. Now, again, in the end, I cannot emphasize this enough. I don't think that Apple's, again, this is one person's interpretation, but
sure.
I don't think their motivation was insidious. They really want to make this better. And one way to do that is to listen to what somebody said, see if Siri did it, and so on. But boy, anybody collecting anybody's personal data, and especially their voice, which is about as personal as it gets, is in very difficult territory.
Paul Hawkman, president of Humongous Media and former tech editor for the Today Show, thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow during Technology Thursday, we'll continue our discussion with Paul on our increasingly connected world. If you missed any part of today's Noon Business Hour, we'll have the replay podcast available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Radio.com app.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.